Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Welcome to the healing service during Holy Week. And if you were here at Palm Sunday, you know that Holy Week is a time for really, really long readings. And that tradition continues in the healing service. This passage in Hebrews is so powerful, and as I was going through it today, I kept thinking, okay, maybe I can cut it here, and I thought, no, that next chapter is so good, and whatever, and I just was like, I don't know where to stop it, so I just said, you know what, we're just going to push through it, and we're going to have a long reading today. Because in this part of Hebrews, and I know you didn't come for like a straight-up Bible study, but that might be a little bit of what tonight is. Because tonight we're talking about the topic of guilt. Guilt, particularly in the Bible, is there's two things that I want to look at tonight with guilt. One is objective guilt, and the other is subjective guilt. And if you know your philosophy, then you know the difference between those two. And if you're an English teacher, you also know the difference between objective and subjective. Subjective meaning me as I'm the subject, you're the subject, everybody's their own subject, and everybody has their own truth. And I'm teasing. And objective would be something outside of us, you know, like the actual truth, you know, like subjectively we might all agree, like I don't believe there's anything such thing as gravity. And everyone says, yes, we all agree. There's no such thing as gravity. We're throwing that off of our backs. Literally, it's been holding us down, literally. That's a good joke. And we're gonna break free, of gravity altogether. And we're all going to go to the highest building in Winter Park, and we're going to jump off. And then we will collide with objective truth, which is truth that is true regardless of whether or not you agree with it or even know about it. And the way this applies with guilt is that you and I experience guilt, or maybe I shouldn't say experience, but you and I interact with guilt in two ways. One is subjectively. There are times in your life when you feel guilty. There are things right now that you feel guilty about. Maybe that's why you're here tonight. There's something that drew you here of which you feel guilty. Guilt, in a biblical sense, is basically, the best way to understand it is a knowledge of a gap between who we are and who we ought to be. It's the knowledge of a gap between who we are and who we know we should be. We feel guilty for all kinds of things. But the more pressing matter, and the matter in which the Bible is first and foremost concerned, is that you and I actually have an interaction with guilt way before it becomes a subjective reality, way before it becomes something that we are aware of or that we feel. That you and I's connection to guilt is actually first and foremost objective. In other words, you and I are guilty for things, as we said in this confession tonight, things done and left undone. Maybe even guilty for things that we have no idea that we even did. That the real trouble of guilt is that regardless of our protestations or our defenses or our justifications, that the Bible is clear that you and I are rendered guilty before God. That's the starting point of everything, the starting point of all theology, that you and I, before a holy and just God, are guilty. You might not feel guilty. You might be having a great day, and I just ruined it a little bit. But that objective reality that you and I are guilty is important, because what you and I are actually sometimes really good at is we are really good at masking or dealing with the subjective guilt. You and I experience guilt all the time, and we have become masters at, when I was younger, my mom asked me to clean my room. She'd be like, you know, Jared, clean your room. When I come back, it better be clean. Okay, great. And what, as every, 12-year-old boy, if you have a son or a nephew or anybody or a daughter, it could, you know, they do it too. What do we immediately do? We take all the toys that we have and we hide them. We don't clean anything. We just shove them under the bed. I remember in college having friends over to our house, and I'd be like, oh my gosh, I probably should clean this room. And I would just open the closet and shove everything in and just barely get the closet door shut and latched, and just leave it there, and then wouldn't open it forever because it would be an instant avalanche. That this is actually the way that you and I often deal with our guilt, that we just find ways to mask it. We just find ways to kind of surface level deal with it. We distract from it. We get our mind off of it. Maybe we drink. Maybe we watch the next Netflix documentary about whatever it could possibly be. We watch, this is why reality TV became like the number one form of TV entertainment, is because everyone felt really guilty, and watching it made them feel less guilty, made them feel better, because these people were worse. It's why we gossip. It's why we often hate people. It's why we get angry with people. It's why we get angry with people that have done nothing to us. Anything I can do to distract my conscience from what's going on. Well, anything I can do to alleviate that. The other thing we do is we defend ourselves. We are masters at justifying the things that you and I have done. Now, maybe you would not be so brash as to come out and say that you've never done something wrong. No, I mean, you know, no one in here, hopefully, would. If you did, if you would, let's talk after, actually. That'd be a great, great moment for you. Very few of us would go through life saying, I've never done anything wrong. But actually what we're really good at is we are amazing lawyers in that we will plead guilty to minor charges in order to avoid looking at some of the felonies, you know, so to speak. But we are very willing to say, oh, no, I'm by no means perfect. I do some things. And then the things that we are talking about, the things that we're fine letting slip out, the things that we're fine leaking in our constant PR with everyone around us, the things that we're constantly able to, oh yeah, I got some bad habits, you know, I eat too much chocolate, or, yelled at my kids this week, or, you know, haha. But that one thing that you know, that's on your mind right now, even when I just said that one thing, that's the thing that we're actually really good at making sure that not only can we convince everyone else around us, maybe even you've never had anyone ask you about it, but yet you have worked up a defense. I know exactly what I'm going to say if somebody ever asked me about this thing. You've been driving alone in the car, going over your defense, over why you weren't wrong to do what you did. And that's the thing that God is actually looking at, saying, whoa, what's this? And we are so good at justifying those things, the things that we know that we've done that were wrong, the things that we know that we've done that have hurt people, much less the things that we know that if we stood before an almighty and holy and righteous God, we could not stand very long. Those are the things that we have done everything we can to figure out some way in which it wasn't my fault. To figure out it's not my fault, it's society. It's not my fault, it's my mom, it's my dad, it's my husband, it's my employer. You don't know what my life was like. We are masters at making sure that the blame never rests squarely on our shoulders. But we think if we can diversify the blame a little bit, then it'll be less of a burden. And so that's all the subjective reality of guilt that we're really good at basically becoming functional with. Like, you can go through life. You're not by any means happy, or you know, it's a burden you're carrying, but you've managed to make it work. But the what the Bible first and foremost wants to address is that God is not the way the Bible puts it is that God is not mocked. God is not an idiot. He doesn't buy your PR. He doesn't read your Facebook status and think, "Oh my gosh, look, she's so happy with him. I thought she would have been happy with her husband, but now look at her. I was wrong." You know, God is not an idiot. He's not sitting up there going, "I never thought about society." That's a great point. I didn't even know your mom was like that. You know, whatever it might be, that he is not playing the game that you think that you can get him on. And this is a truth that we all know, that we all try to avoid, that we think that we've got everyone, and maybe you do, maybe you genuinely do have everyone around you fooled. You have every single person you've ever interacted with that you've given your story, they have bought it hook, line, and sinker, and they have felt sorrow for you, and they have felt empathy for you, and you have taken it all, and you think, I got another one. I'm amazing at this, and yet at the same time, you feel this sense of unease, because you also think, but no one knows me. Like, no one actually knows what really actually happened. Because I know that this story is not true. And someday, somebody's gonna find out. And then what happens? And the first thing that we need to come to grips with tonight is that God is not an idiot. He knows you. He has not bought a single one of your stories or your alibis. That he sees through every single motivation that you have. He sees through every single defense. And that his law is completely and utterly absolute. It offers no distinctions. It offers no kind of, well, okay, if thou shalt not murder, except in these couple of situations. Thou shalt not commit adultery, except if your marriage is really bad. You know, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, except blah, 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 whatever it might be. Thou shalt not covet, except if they got the newest Tesla or whatever. That's not how the law of God works. The law of God is a black and white statement out into the world that say, this is what righteousness demands of you. And if you are not perfect in this, then you have fallen short. We had a recent youth event where the speaker is named Tom Phillips. He's one of the best preachers in our diocese. He's a priest in our diocese. He was talking to our students, and I had never even heard it put this beautifully and simply. He told our students, everybody think about this one sin in your life that you just think is kind of inconsequential and funny. Just like that one thing that it's really genuinely not that big of a deal. And you know, it's just kind of like a little foible or a little like, haha, that's funny. And think about, think about for a second, maybe the worst thing that you have ever done. And the first thing that we have to come to grips with is that both of those are damning before God. That's what the righteousness of God demands, is utter, complete perfection. You are either perfect or you are guilty. And there's no chance for you to offer like a rebuttal to that. And so the first thing that the Bible deals with is objectively, you are guilty. Whether you know it or not, whether you feel it or not, whether you have found every single possible place to defend yourself from that accusation. That there is nowhere you can run, nowhere you can hide from that declaration that you are guilty. You have fallen short of the glory of God. And this is, and the Hebrews passage is speaking to that, the trappings of religion, The things like the tabernacle and all the things of the old covenant in Hebrews, what he's looking at is saying, why is it that what we have as Christians, it could possibly be better than what we had in the Old Testament? What is so good now? And what he's talking about is that while the Old Testament, while the things of the Old Testament, were good and that they pointed to the reality that you and I were sinners, that you and I, that there is a price for sin and that, that sin in some way disconnects us with God, that what it's saying is that when the blood of these bulls and goats, that it was sprinkled on copies of heavenly things. In other words, the tabernacle and the vestments and the veils and all of the things that were in the temple were meant to be signs or types of that pointed to heavenly realities. For you and I to go, well, what's heaven like? God said, well, it's like this. Build this tabernacle and build it this way so that you could know what my holiness might kind of look like. And symbolically, the priest would go in and he would sprinkle these things with blood as a sign of this is what it's going to take to redeem Israel from their sins, that even in God's presence, there must be some kind of sacrifice, some kind of atonement that is made. But what Hebrews talks about is the blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sin, that this blood was merely put onto these copies of realities, not the thing itself. That there would have to be some kind of further sacrifice in which that blood that would go to the real thing, straight into the heart of heaven itself, and do some kind of work, some kind of cleansing there before anything could ever actually be done objectively. And then that gets applied to the subjective, that you and I will continue to feel guilty as long as we haven't dealt with that objective reality. And so with the lesson of Hebrews is saying is that the beauty of the gospel is that it's the proclamation that something objective has actually occurred. That your guilt has been dealt with. First and foremost, with God himself. It talks about how the high priest in the old covenant would have to remain standing, that he would have to continually be standing up, offering sacrifices day after day for the sins of the world. When he said, and every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifice, which can never take away sins. It's this exhaustion. The text is evoking these priests standing daily trying to do these things and knowing this isn't going to get the job done. It's not really going to take away sins. And maybe for you and I, it wasn't an ancient Israelite priest, but maybe it is that story that you keep telling everybody. Maybe it is that post that you keep putting up on Facebook to make sure everybody knows that you're fine. This sense of I have to keep this alibi up. Because if anyone ever found out that it's not true, then everything would begin to fall apart. And there's an exhaustion. That the reality of you and I carrying guilt is it becomes wearisome. It becomes a baggage. Offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. In other words, he is not standing in front of God continually offering sacrifices in order to try to absolve every single sin that has happened. Instead, he offered one time and for all time one sacrifice, a single sacrifice for sins, and then he sat down at the right hand of God. It's over. That which needed to happen to absolve you for your guilt has happened. It has occurred. The one sacrifice, not the blood of bulls and goats, but the blood of one man who had no sin, who according to the law of God, obeyed it perfectly. Who was guiltless. The one person who actually never would have experienced guilt or never would have experienced that sense of a gap between who he should have been and who he was. The one person who could have stood before God and said, I am exactly who I need to be. And God would have declared him righteous as the one person who went to the death of a common criminal and took on himself the sins of the entire world and has paid for them. The first and foremost answer to your subjective experience of guilt is to understand that objectively your sins have been paid for. Full stop. That there is nothing that you owe God for the things that you have done or left undone. That there is no secret back room where they have a secret file on you that says, oh, no, she actually did. That Christ in his sacrifice went into the depths of the depths, into the holy of holies, into the one back room to rule them all. And he pulled out the entire filing cabinet and he nailed it to his own cross. And it's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. I mean, Paul talks about that in Colossians. Your record of wrongdoing, if you could imagine God just keeping a list of everything that you've done, he says in Colossians 2, that was nailed to the cross. It's gone. In heaven, there is like a great emptying of the filing cabinets. They just have, I guarantee you when we get up to heaven, there's just going to be a ton of empty filing cabinets where God's like, yeah, well, these used to be full. And 2,000 years ago, they all got emptied. And I don't know where they went. That's exactly the imagery that God is using when he says, I will remember your sins no more. And that will be applied to you when you feel guilty. When you feel that feeling of I'm not who I ought to be. The beauty of the gospel is that you can say, of course I'm not. But that has been paid for. That has been paid for. The Zechariah reading. And we'll end with this. It depicts the high priest of Israel standing before God, and the setting that we're ushered into is one of trouble, because if the high priest is standing before God in tattered garments and dirty and nasty, then that spells disaster for the people that the high priest stands to represent before God. And so when Zechariah looks into this vision, he sees Joshua, the high priest, standing before God, completely in tatters and disheveled and dirty. And he says that Satan is standing next to him, accusing him. See, Satan is not this kind of guy who shows up on your shoulder saying, well, go here instead of go that, you know, do the bad thing. No, Satan's usually very quiet when you're thinking about what should I do, the right thing or the wrong thing. It's when you do the wrong thing that Satan starts talking. That's one of the biggest keys to unlocking your whole spiritual life, is recognizing the voice of Satan. That Satan is not the voice telling you at the beginning, like, oh, you know, go this way. You don't actually need another voice to tell you because you're actually a sinner. Satan's actually that voice that comes alongside you and says, I knew you'd do that. Of course you'd do that. You always do that. This is who you are. That he's the prosecutor of heaven. He stands before God and says, this person is guilty. Look at them. And in this throne room, Satan is, and he's rightly accusing him, and Joshua is disheveled. He's dirty before God. And it says that the angel of the Lord, which in the Bible, the angel of the Lord is, whenever you see that in the Old Testament, it's code for Jesus. That the angel of the Lord stands before Joshua. And he silences this accusation from Satan. He says, Satan, I rebuke you. The Lord rebuke you, O Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this a brand plucked from the fire? In other words, he's saying, I've already chosen to save him. I chose that a long time ago before he ever did any of the things that he's done. He belongs to me. He's mine. So you should stop talking now. The Lord rebuke you. And now Joshua is standing before the angel clothed with filthy garments. And this is what Christ does for us in our subjective guilt, in our feelings of I am guilty before God. He not only declares us innocent objectively before him, but he comes to him, standing before him, and the angel Lord comes to him and says, remove the filthy garments from him. And to him he said, behold, I have taken your iniquity away from you, and I will clothe you with pure vestments. Let them put a clean turban on his head. And so they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord was standing by. So tonight, that message is for you, wherever you're at, and however guilty you might feel or not feel. It's Christ coming to you in his word right now in this moment on April 4th, 2023 and saying, behold, this holy week, behold, I have taken all your iniquity from you. You don't have it anymore. It's gone. And I will clothe you with pure vestments. I will clothe you with my own righteousness so that you stand before God not in filthy garments, but in the very righteousness of Christ. That's how God sees you. So whatever that guilt is that you have, my hope for you tonight is that you just bring it to the God who's promised that whatever it is he will deliver you out of, that he has sent his son to pay that price. And he offers in exchange for your guilt, he offers you his righteousness for free. Amen.